Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. I'm Pete Coleman, and with me as always, I have Travis J. Dow. Today we talk about some of the magic books, protective charms and spells, and of course, magic rings. That's right. Magic is one of the areas that intersect with alchemy. As we've mentioned several times before, we've taken detours with episodes on thaumaturgy and magic before. This is not uncharted territory for us, since magic is the critical piece of the puzzle to understanding the mind. The common knowledge of the alchemists in the medieval period and the modern age is what we're focusing on today. In this episode, we'll go over the alchemical means of creating a magic ring, for example, one that can point out those who would harm you and those who would betray you or even poison you. This ring would have power. And with a lot of parallels to alchemical recipes of gold making, there are recipes to summon demons or to protect you against those aforementioned demons, right? So in this episode is intended to give you, the listener, a deeper understanding of the alchemist's knowledge and mind. Sort of like the episode on biblical characters as alchemists that we've talked about before, or alchemical allusions and symbols. Understanding all of this helps us understand alchemy a little bit better. For this episode, Travis went to the museum in Halle, where they had an exhibit of rings of power throughout the ages, and the university library at Leipzig, where they have an exhibit on magical books and spells, including some alchemy. So Travis, take it away.
Yeah, so if y'all remember, wait, that wasn't even for alchemy, that was for a history of Germany. But so Bodler, Mirko Gudjar is his name, we've actually had him on the show for... why was he on alchemy? For sure he was here, but I've had him on History of Germany for this guy, Disc of Nebra, this like Bronze Age sort of calendar, also a very powerful symbol that might have been used as a banner at some point, but a Bronze Age depiction of the sky and the moon and sun and like when the sun would rise for certain times, kind of a, you know, to be used as a calendar, for example. And I've also had him on for when we talked about Martin Luther, especially on the history of Germany, because...
When you went to Wittenberg, right?
Yep, for the 500-year anniversary of Martin Luther nailing his 95 thesis on the cathedral or the church door, starting the Reformation, or at least one of the kind of landmark events starting the Reformation. So this time, now he lives in Leipzig, he has a newborn baby and is married.
And congratulations, by the way, Bühler. Oh, he's a fan favorite of several shows, and he's a friend of our show.
Yeah, so
right?
So also, in fact, I translate his Das Geheime Kabinett into English, which is, you know, he does it in German, as The Secret Cabinet, which is right now, as of like December 2019, our number one show. It passed History of Germany.
It doesn't surprise me. It's a great show.
It's crazy. It's literally like the weird stories of history, and Bühler is an archaeologist by trade, so has tons of stories of digging up stuff in Cornwall, like King Arthur's era, and
he also went to the Vatican too. I remember you telling me that story.
I think we talked about him in the secret archives.
Yeah, when the secret archives, and when I was in the Vatican a few years ago, he was on my mind because I went right by that door that was under security. I was like, oh, I wish I could have gone in there with Bühler because that would have been pretty awesome.
So he's just full of stories, and he gave me a private tour of the Martin Luther House when I was in Wittenberg, but now he also gave me a private tour of an exhibit he worked on in Halle, and then also just the university library in Leipzig, like you mentioned. But his depth of knowledge is fantastic because he knows like what's missing in an exhibit, so it's kind of an artist pointing out all the flaws of a painting that you wouldn't see, you know, the stuff they didn't get, or each item would have a little description next to it, but he can tell you the whole story. He's like, we found this, and then, you know, this led to this and this. And so he's at the forefront, the very forefront of some of the things we're going to be talking about today, which was unknown even 10 years ago. So some of this stuff is, even if you've, you know, treaded over magic rings and magic books and stuff before, we're going to bring some new stuff to the table today.
Now, when you say magic rings, I think for many of our listeners, including this guy right here across from you on the microphone, I think of, like, you know, Tolkien's sort of Lord of the Rings. You know, that's kind of, when you think magic rings for me, I think of what I grew up listening or watching The Hobbit, or reading the stories about, you know, the ring that would was made for different reasons for the story. Many rings, as a matter of fact. So this goes back to antiquity when we're talking about the power of rings, right?
So actually, we're gonna mention the Tolkien ring a couple of times. First of all, they did have a replica of, you know, it's a fictional story,
sure,
but they did have the Ring of Power.
Oh, is it, by the way?
Yeah, just in case you didn't know.
I didn't know.
But they did have that in the museum.
Cool.
And Budler also gave me like two big books, written by academics, several articles, some in English, some in German, most in German maybe, and they all kind of made an allusion to Tolkien, because Tolkien was also an academic and studied languages, and there's the Nibelungen Ring from Wagner, for instance, but there's also in folklore, part of the exhibit was going way back to Celtic ages, of like they'd have these torques, these solid gold or brass or whatever, but gold for a while, and when the Byzantine Empire was a thing, these solid rings around their necks, and then the Romans would wear them as trophies on their armor. So you see like statues or graves with Roman soldiers, if they fought Celts, you would see these like rings hanging from their breastplates, you know? So I mean, we'll come across that again and again, because Tolkien was onto something, like the whole creation of the ring, the whole, like, I mean, even these academics are just kind of talking about The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings over and over in these academic texts. So, that's just a little side note there. I thought that was interesting, but...
Maybe Steve Colbert is listening, because he's a Hobbit aficionado.
He's not listening, first of all.
Okay. He might be. Who knows? He's got magical rings. He can look at it.
So for those of you that thought we kind of dropped off the planet for the last couple of years, that's not the case. We've probably been, other than Pete.
Yeah, I went to Mars.
We've been busy. We've been probably producing still an episode a week on average of various
shows.
Stuff.
Absolutely.
Some of them are in German. Like now there's 150 episodes about U.S. history in German that, you know, you might be unaware of and you might not care about if you don't speak German. But the other big show we've been working on, the big show, the flagship of Podcastnik Productions, is Past Access.
Yeah.
Which,
thanks, man.
Well, the production value is crazy. First of all, it's a one-man show. Pete travels the world in a wheelchair, as he does. And we have episodes on Barcelona, on Dresden, even, you know, hometowns of like D.C. and zipped over to Baltimore.
Stockholm, Florence.
Stockholm. And these are on YouTube, because this is like heavy, like editing video is a whole nother league. And with the effects and the, you know, the kind of the, it looks like you have fun doing it too. Like I'm thinking of the boy with the meatballs.
Yeah, it's great. And you know what's really cool about this is that when I'm going to these places around the world, I slip into all these different type of museums and locations.
Oh, the ABBA Museum. You guys, okay. you have to...
You brought up ABBA.
You okay, yeah. have to go awesome. Watch Past Access on YouTube.
I was going to keep it connected to alchemy, but fine. All right, pop culture is cool too. But I will go to places like Stockholm, and I will go up to see... You know, alchemical areas there that were done during the time of the late 1700s.
We've talked about the Devil's Bible,
right?
Which was, you know, written in Moravia, I guess, in the Czech Republic.
I got
but
to
is
see
now
it. I got to see it
in
man.
Stockholm. Yeah.
I got to see it at the National Archives in Sweden. And so sometimes these shows kind of intersect with each other, and it's great. And if you haven't seen Past Access on YouTube yet, go to Past Access. You can also go to pastaccess.com. And
get
follow,
your lives together.
Yeah,
what are you even doing?
What are you doing? Because you can follow me around. And it's not just a show for people in wheelchairs. That's a nice benefit. That's my passion project.
Well, so
but it's about history.
There's fantastic travel tips of like what's accessible and what's not accessible, or what you should do. Maybe you have to call ahead. Maybe it's just fully accessible. Maybe you just get someone's attention and they'll, you know, have a little lift for the trains. What I think is great is that, yeah, if you're if you do have some like mobility issues, then it might give you the confidence to be like, oh, if a loser like Pete can, no. I mean,
no, seriously. Actually, if Pete can do it, oh my gosh, anybody can do it.
Pete can do it. Yeah,
but this is an inclusive show. It's for everybody, you know.
And we got Florence coming up, Venice coming up.
Yeah, Florence, Venice, Paris, Prague.
Yeah,
yeah,
Prague, yeah.
A lot to do going into season two.
Pete still lives in Prague, which is a very magical city.
Yeah,
and so stay tuned. Subscribe on YouTube. Past Access is what it is. It'll be in the show notes. In fact, it's on the show notes of every episode, in case you've been missing it lately. But and then otherwise, go check out The Secret Cabinet, especially because that will give you a little bit of the insight into the devious mind of Der Buddler. And he was kind of the inspiration for this episode. So, so when we talk about magic, I wrote it in here somewhere. Maybe I'll start with this. What magic and alchemy have in common, which is kind of interesting, which is the difference between like straight up shamanism or even religion, is that magic and alchemy were this sort of replicable process where you're following a recipe, which is the same philosophy of science. So you might read this spell or do this certain ritual or do something in a certain way, and you have expected outcomes. You don't need to be a priest or a holy man or even necessarily have faith. It was, although often, we talked about this before, alchemical processes did often require you to, contemplate God, or, you know, there was a religious aspect to it, and we can't divorce the religion of the time, or, you know, the religious thinking of the time from the magical thinking. But it's interesting to note that just as alchemy is a sort of pseudoscience where it is the predecessor to chemistry, where you're mixing different things in a lab and then you get this chemical reaction and this other thing happens, the same thing was actually magical thinking.
Well, you have to talk about scientific method. I mean, that's also an alchemical sort of byproduct of this, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, what if there were no coincidences? But also maybe no, you know, the laws of nature or physics either. Or what if you could suspend the laws of nature or physics? Klaus Priesner, one of the guys that wrote an article for this exhibit, basically said that magic is basically the knowledge and ability to change things which you could not change without such magical knowledge. So you're changing reality. If you didn't have this ring of power or this spell, then life would go on as usual. But with this talisman or amulet, you're afforded extra protection. Or there's crazy stuff. Literally like invisibility cloaks and, you know, or rings of invisibility, just like the Hobbit. So we have rituals that will, you know, give you a ring of invisibility, for instance. You can see the past and the future and then, you know, change the laws of nature or even change other people's behavior and actions. You could create miracles, so to speak. So if you're a theologian, like a priest or someone, then you might believe in miracles also, but that they come directly from God. And again, okay, we've talked about this before. The source of the magic could be demonic. It could be from God. But the thing is, the belief was that if you follow this ritual, say these words, do these actions, then you can, in a sense, force the supernatural to do your bidding. Okay. But in a replicable way, in a way that you follow these steps and you get this result, which is... it's the backbone of science too.
It's a kind of a class in psychology though, that if you believe in something tactile that you have that's going to give you confidence, do you think maybe it might further what you're going to be doing?
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe there's something to it.
Because
psychosomatic.
So we're not here to tell you that magic is real or that any of these things worked. In fact, we're pretty sure none of these things worked, to be honest. So
let's leave the door open a little bit.
You know,
just
for fun. We've gotten like criticism for being like overly skeptical. Like, how dare we talk about these things and yet not believe in it?
Yeah.
We're skeptical in a way. People have called us not spiritual. We're both like religious people.
Yeah, I would say so. But yeah.
Yeah. But it's the I guess what I'm trying to point out is the difference between magical thinking and alchemical thinking is it's not some intuitive thing like going into a trance or praying. You can learn this. So you might be an apprentice from a sorcerer, a magician, or whatever. And that's the difference between priests and shamans. Priests and shamans will act in faith. And, you know, this is the difference is if you say a prayer, something might happen, something might not happen. But this is the idea behind this, at least, was it's replicable. You follow a spell and the same thing happens every time, if done right. Just like, and that's a big asterisk or a big caveat. Like, you didn't do it right. Well, you probably didn't do it at the right, the correct full moon under the right star sign or, you know, the right zodiac sign, which is the same, like, preconditions for alchemy. So, you know, it comes from the same worldview. These are the same people doing these things, basically.
Well, I might be jumping the gun here as we go further into the show, but, you know, is it possible that some of these rings were made of some kind of metal or some kind of maybe poison that would react to somebody's skin when they put it on, that they would actually see certain things? Is that even possible that we're that metallurgy could be reactive to someone's biochemistry?
That you're touching on an interesting point there, that if you go far enough back to some of the shamanistic rituals where they might have been, like, I want to say licking toads. That's the wrong, but you know, eating.
There's
eating,
a shaman being very upset with that comment right
but
now.
But like, so like the whole idea of like ayahuasca or, you know, eating a fungus that will kind of open your mind into another realm, let's say. I wouldn't exclude that. I would say in the Middle Ages, they thought differently. Like if you got ergot poisoning, like let's say that's one of the theories of the Salem witch trials, mm-hmm. then it was probably a demonic thing and you'd be burned as a witch if you suddenly see these visions. Other times, who knows where all those visions came from? Like Joan of Arc, was she schizophrenic? Are we being heretics?
We could talk about that rye bread mold that you're talking about that gave people the dancing fever.
Yeah,
you don't know what's going to happen in the medieval tales about what creates these illusions.
So
right?
They had their worldview where, well, that didn't fit with the Catholic vibe at the time, so they might be seen as, you know, demon possessed.
Yeah.
Whereas other times, and this kind of fits into one thing I want to talk about, is why are we built like that? So 100,000 years ago, Neanderthals buried their dead and took care of the ill. You know, they believed in, were you lucky or unlucky, which is already, like, we could say that Neanderthals believed in luck or believed in, you know, being dealt the wrong hand, because if everybody was purely atheist and we were just like these animal, had these animal instincts of, you know, survival of the fittest, then why are we taking care of the ill? You know, because, you know, you're the weakest link in the chain, you're holding us all back. We should just abandon you somewhere. And that did not happen even in other hominids, let alone like the Celtic ages and, you know, just throughout human history. There's no part of human history anywhere on the world that didn't have some of these beliefs. For instance, life after death. If you're anybody from like Vikings to Celts to Germanic peoples, this is kind of, I don't know how many of you listen to like History of Germany, but I'm touching on some of those topics where, why are they even buried with burial goods? You know what? So they might follow you
or
to the afterlife,
or slaves,
horses, or, you know, other animals. And they're found with feathers and like bird bones and everything.
Sure.
And I'm skipping around geographically a lot. You know, in the exhibit, it would point out that it had that too. It had a Bronze Age thing. There was Neanderthals there. And it was kind of trying to point out that throughout Europe, it doesn't matter what time period from Roman, which is like now we're into classical history where they had writing sources and we kind of know what they thought, like the Greek gods and Roman gods. Clearly, they believed in an afterlife, a sort of parallel world, like maybe a spirit world, you know, something beyond the visible. And one thing that Budler kind of clarified for me is I know that Vikings, let's say, like Norse religion, they might break a sword or bend a sword and then throw it away. And the belief was you'd often find even shattered rings and stuff with the burial, you know, with human remains. And that is because, well, let's think about this. And this might be a little bit of a theorizing, but these are people much smarter than me doing the theorizing here. This isn't my idea. That when you die, your human remains kind of you know, decompose and you turn into a skeleton and, you know, finally maybe nothing. And the belief was that there's an afterlife, that maybe there's an immortal soul. You know, you don't want to get into specifics because we're talking about thousands and thousands of years of history, but the things that decay here are whole in that parallel world or in the afterlife. So if you want somebody to have their horse, well, you kill the horse and put it in the grave with them, but or the slaves, like you mentioned. But that also applies to amulets and We know this from Celts and Germanic peoples and then later Vikings, that they would smash something, throw it in the grave, thinking that if it's broken here, it would then become whole in the other world.
Oh, that's interesting.
So as a coin rusts, it's becoming whole in the other world. So things that decay on this planet, they're just crossing that veil of, you know, it's a very Halloween sort of idea.
Well, it is, but you know, you're saying on this side of the planet here in Europe, but of course in North America, the Amerindians.
Of course. Every civilization ever.
Like, for instance, the one story coming to me was the Battle of Little Bighorn. And after the Ninth Cavalry was decimated, Indian women came over, you know, taking off fingertips and putting holes through ears so they would listen in the afterlife better.
Yeah.
Right? So, so there was that kind of issue going on, and I can only imagine in Mesoamerica, same sort of situation too. Mm-hmm. I'm not an expert on that. But you have these symbols and these tokens that you have that are important. You talked about like amulets, right?
Yeah.
Or talismans,
yep.
Right? That go back, and this
goes
back.
Those were in the exhibit too?
Yeah, absolutely. So rings are part of this, aren't they?
Rings are definitely a part of it. There's, so let's, you know, if you follow along, just accept the idea for now that there are things as angels and demons. Also, maybe that's a very Judeo-Christian
idea. It is. Yin and yang too, right?
But let's say spirits, ghosts, maybe the dead. And, you know, like Halloween goes back before Christian times in like, you know, Celtic Britain, let's say. But you know, and then you might have shamans or mediums that can communicate with them. There's ideas that you can interact with them. And then even in, you know, Christian times in the Middle Ages, that never went away. That, you know, the church tried to stamp a lot of those beliefs out. Even one of the articles was saying like, don't burn incense at your house to like Odin, or don't hang wreaths on your on the outside of your house for protection, because those are all like heathen, like pagan symbols. And we know we're all Christian now. We don't do that anymore. But the idea of folk magic. So the horseshoe. I'm going to say the wrong thing. That was Odin or Thor? Odin, I think.
Yeah.
So sometimes you would even see Odin, Vodan in the Germanic sense, but Odin in Norse mythology. And you would see horseshoes with like Vodan engraved on horseshoes. That would be, so in Germany, I grew up, you still often see a horseshoe above somebody's front door.
Now, do you see upside down or upside upright side?
Oh, that has a meaning, right?
Because in America, in North America, you'll see that in most barns, and we'll talk about maybe witch hexes that you would paint on the side of a barn in Pennsylvania. Yep. But as far as the horseshoes were always turned up on the wall, because the luck would run out if you had it down.
Yeah.
Right?
So most people, you know, in this day and age might call that a superstition, but the fact that, you know, the four-leaf clover is a luck bringer, like, you know, you're trying to attract, it's really like the good spirits to you and ward off the bad spirits from peoples that didn't think in terms of angels and demons, but like goblins and elves, you know? In fact, even some of these medieval, we're talking about these like, lead leaflets, sort of lead pieces of paper. They're really thin, kind of like tin foil, and folded together. And this is part of the research that's brand new. So Budler was you know, part of the team that was really figuring out and deciphering the very first ones of these, because they look like bullets. It's just a lead little brick, and you can kind of tell, okay, it's been folded together, but they're so fragile that for years they would, you know, you wouldn't even know what you're finding. Like, you'd think, oh, it's a piece of a farmer's equipment in a field. And then slowly they thought, okay, well, let's unfold one, because we have a couple of these now. And they took the risk, and then they found out, oh, there's cryptic symbols on the inside. Later they found others. When they started to do this work, then other museums would say, oh, we have this little lead blob too. You know, why don't you go ahead and do your thing? Yeah. And they would open them up and find crucifixes or the, in alchemy, I think we've talked about this, but like the Seal of Solomon, it's this, so imagine a six-sided, like a Cairo, like a six-sided, not a star, but a like three lines intersecting. So north, south, and then kind of northeast to southwest and northwest to southeast, you know, so six pointed sort of star, but just three lines. And in magical books that might be very ornate, because these are like actual magicians studying the craft, Kabbalists, which we've done an episode on, and it has this really deep meaning, which you come across in alchemy all the time, to like folk magic, where they didn't really get it all right. They might get the symbols at the end of the lines wrong. It might just look like a crow's foot, but they'd still have it in these lead tablets. and they would wear them like talismans, either around their neck or maybe an armband or somewhere. Same idea with rings, and just wear them as a protective talisman, basically. Now, let me waste a couple of words here on the University Library of Leipzig. Leipzig is Faust's town. So we did an episode on Faust, right?
When he was here in Prague.
Goethe,
air quotes.
He was in Wittenberg. Now, there are sources of him studying in Wittenberg. Yeah. Dr. Faust, there are sources of him being in Prague.
The Faust House.
There's the Faust House. Right. There's definitely legends of him being in Prague. And for those that have, you know, just heard the name, Faust was kind of a real character. Like, so he does show up in literature as like there is a Dr. Faust, and maybe he was chased out of a town or two, but there probably was actually more than one. I don't think it's that uncommon of a name. But he's the one that made a deal with the devil, and there's like Mephistopheles and the whole, trying to, it's a tale against greed, because in the end he kind of got his just desserts. But Leipzig is the Faust town. There's statues of him everywhere. There's, you know, there's a shopping mall passage, basically, and then there's this big statue and a plaque, and I took pictures of it, you know, and it's like, you go down there, that's the room where he met the devil. Like, the, you know, Wittenberg has the same, Prague has the same, but Goethe's Faust takes place in Leipzig. So that's, so one thing about the Uni Leipzig, I'm going to put it in the show notes, but it's Uni, as in university, uni-leipzig.de/+magica, so the plus symbol magica, and that will give you all the search results. You can actually go and download PDFs of all these magic books, 50 pages at a time. There's Albertus Magnus. We've done a show on him. Sure. They mentioned, oh boy, it's eluding me now, but so many people we've talked about on the show that they were either mentioned or it's like pseudo that person, like, you know, somebody using their name. But you can actually find the whole collection online. They've made it available publicly. And the whole collection, this is kind of an interesting backstory of the exhibit itself, is the whole collection showed up in Leipzig in 1710. It's 140 magical works, often handwritten. So some rich nobleman or someone with money, clearly, would pay people to copy these texts as they came into his possession. And in 1710, they were sold for 4,000 Reichstaler. That's the cost of like two or three nice houses, houses, whatever. Right. So a small fortune.
And these were texts that were mostly done in German, Germany, right? And so probably German language.
For a German patron, for sure.
Okay, so however, the fact that the rituals were somewhat complicated, the preparations were very extensive, and especially, so the high level of this was, a high level of expensive. You can see that the money was coming in for this.
For the educated.
For the only educated. So that you had to be pretty comfortable with, Latin to kind of understand some of the higher points of this.
It's just mixed right in.
Yep. Right. And then you also would have these guys, we talked about the higher class. What are they? Doctors?
Yeah.
Apothecaries.
Yep.
Those type of
like
folks, right?
The jurists, the teachers, book dealers, because they just had access to books and were educated. Educated traders, like the people that handled the people that sold and bought books were, had to know what they were dealing with. But also, clearly, also pastors and theologians. Because this is the intended audience for these books, like not the folk magic type. These are like actual written down rituals. In fact, in the exhibit, they had this big like magic circle. I just know it from like Supernatural or like those TV shows where they have or all the horror movies where they deal with like demonic possession.
They write something on the ground.
So if you're going to summon a demon, either be in the circle, depending on your source, either be in the circle and summon your demon, or be outside of the circle and you summon the demon in the circle so that he can't escape.
This is what kind of throws me off a little bit. And since you grew up in Munich, Travis, maybe you can speak more to this as far as the history is concerned. To me, at this time in Germany, we're talking about the Protestant Reformation.
Yeah.
Right? And to me, from my I know of that, is that the occult statuses and those type of things that were kind of ethereal were really looked down upon by the Protestants. The Catholics,
for sure.
The Catholics kind of had
it. And the mainstream.
But the Protestants were like, dude, no, we don't believe in that baloney anymore.
So here's...
How did that work?
Here's the funny thing. A lot of those books will have a prologue that is like... It's kind of like the teacher of the dark arts in Harry Potter. It's like...
We're covering everything tonight.
We're covering everything. Well, you have to mention that too. They mentioned that in the exhibit as well, over and over and over again. There's a Harry Potter reference.
Oh, Harry Potter.
I was like, you can't go to that exhibit.
How's it in German?
Harry Potter.
Harry Potter.
Harry Potter.
And hold on. Let me talk to that for a second first. I don't want to get too off track here. It's just crazy. It's so neat. But yeah, there'd be a prologue where it's saying like, this is bad. Don't summon demons. But here's how you would do it. But, you know, if you wanted to do it, follow these steps. And it's like very explicit on what you're doing. Same as alchemical texts, by the way. It's like, this is forbidden knowledge. We're against this. This goes against the Pope's papal bull, and this goes against the teaching. However, just so you know what you're dealing with, when you come across it, here it is. And then you see the rituals and spells. Not just an allusion to them or mentioning that they exist, but the actual rituals and spells, all the symbols, everything you need to know to summon a demon. Including there was one that caught my eye, which was like abracadabra.
Yeah.
So I was like, I thought this was like from 1001 Nights or some fairy tale, but no, there's like, it had this like magic triangle where it'd be like A and then AB and then ABR and ABRA, and it had abracadabra like spelled out into a matrix. Kind of, and abracadabra as if it was a magic word and a word of power. And
For me, if you're listening, you got kids, especially small kids, and you tell them not teenagers, if you tell them not to do something, they're gonna do it.
Yeah.
Right. So at this point, if the Protestant church was saying don't touch it,
yep.
I still see. I can imagine people gravitating to this stuff like a moth to a flame.
And this could be a Lutheran pastor, saying, don't do it,
but here it is.
And with all the symbols and the deciphering of the symbols, explanations of the symbols, again, the link's in the show notes, but you can go look at these texts yourself. They've made them publicly available. Let's jump from Leipzig to Halle here for a second. So Buddler worked at the University for Halle for several years, but I think that was also maybe 10 years ago now, or at least, you know, ever since I knew him, he was already in Wittenberg. So he left the Landesmuseum in Halle, which is where the Sky Disc of Nebra is. So I got to actually see it in person.
Yeah.
I was so blown
away.
This
was a good trip for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah. And they did it so well. It's just so well. And then Buddler gave me these two really pretty thick hardcover, like hardbound books with all these academic
in English.
Some of them are in English. Yeah. Some of them are in German.
That's nice.
Some of the articles, and then each academic kind of wrote their own thing, often mentioning one specific ring, which Buddler's made a replica for his marriage, his wedding ring, actually. So him and his wife have these.
Before we go any further, because this is a non-visual medium, what does that ring look like, and what are the symbols are?
Well,
are they carved in, or can you see through them like the Lord of the Rings ring?
So this is, they're carved on the outside. And now, so since that, they just happened to find that ring. That ring is believed to be from the 13th century, like 1200, somewhere in there. It has, I believe, 12 symbols on the outside. It's ciphered multiple times. So first of all, the letters are sideways. Then there might actually be a kind of a code for some other letter. And the fact that they're not in the same orientation, like some are upside down, some are backwards, some are, you know, it's really meant to be hidden. So it's not plain text at all. And this one guy came along, which I should really mention his name. He recently passed away, and he just had a wealth of knowledge of this stuff, and he kind of blew everybody away at this one conference where they're like, okay, so based on this, and this tradition, this is what I think it means. And it's, long story short, it's Nine Me XPS, Deny Me Christ, which is in the Philippians book of the Bible.
Wait, you said the word deny me Christ?
Deny me Christ. Yeah, as in, so the...
Like when Peter denied Christ three times?
No, the idea is... that I'm irrelevant. I'm just a servant of the Lord. So I mean nothing, you know. And
okay.
Hence I want to serve you more. Boy, I should pull out the Bible verse now, because I'm just kind of going off of
memory.
That memory in that article. But it's totally so. There were critics that were saying like it could mean nothing, and then they're like, well, why would it mean nothing? Why put all the work into it to mean nothing? And it's a silver ring. And it was found in 1898, but lost until 2002. And I even read the whole history of, like, it was in this, some farmer found it in his, when he dug up a tree, it was, in a pot. like a clay jar and with a bunch of coins. And so it kind of got mixed into the museum and the coin collection and then into a different catalog. And so it just kind of lost. They were looking for it in the 80s and then couldn't find it. So they just put it as lost.
This was in Germany?
Yeah.
So it survived two world wars.
In that era, yeah. Yeah, in the museum in Halle.
Amazing.
In their collection, in their in the attic, so to speak. Like in their, you know, the leftover stuff that's not on exhibit because, you know, they have so many thousands of coins. And but rediscovered, and then and now, so since that research has been done, you know, 2002, 2003 was the first deciphering attempts. They've come across other rings similar. There's another really recent find in Germany, which I'll get to. Well, okay, let me talk about that one. So there was a ring, same thing, letters on the outside. So in general, you might find letters on the inside. They might be a abbreviation of a Bible verse meant for a protective talisman, or even like Ave Maria, like the first letters of the Ave Maria prayer, just kind of as an acronym on the inside or the outside. And one of them, to give you an example, so when the person died, the other people, when they see this ring, they're like, what the heck is that? And they found one ring stamped flat and buried inside of a church and the church ground. So they raised up a tile in some restoration and found this flattened out ring. And the thought was, well, it's an evil ring of power, frankly, and we're going to take it to Mordor. No, I mean, we're going to take it to the cathedral someplace and put it under the tile so it's on consecrated ground.
Right.
So that the church's effect... First of all, it's destroyed, it's flattened out, and then the church's effect of it being sanctioned, you know, holy ground would cancel out any negative effects of the ring. Hmm. So it was literally like laid to rest like a body would be or anybody else in a very Christian sense. So not, you know, it would be there in the afterlife, but it's
before it's the show, we talked banned. About destroying the rings, that the Pope would have his own ring created for him.
Yeah.
And the ring itself, through popes through history, even today's Pope, Pope Francis has one. Yep. And there's something that's very specific for that Pope as far as maybe his heredity line.
And it's smashed or destroyed.
And when he dies, it is completely destroyed.
So there was actually one papal ring in the exhibit too. And it's so some of those rings are crazy, just ornate. Yeah. And, you know, to give a little more context, I mean, the last article in the book was even on smart rings. Because like today's wearables, you it measures your heart rate. You can pay with it like a credit card. It might have storage in it. So you might have your personal data in it. It might have your medical data in it. What is that? So, you know, they kind of put it in the context, well, it's the latest archaeological shift layer, which is like the present tense and future tense even. I don't have a smart ring yet. You know, I'm too plebeian to afford one, I guess. And so, you know, we still have this idea of, you know, a ring that has all these functions beyond just the it's a piece of jewelry or it's a... And in fact, so in German, the word magic, Magie, power, Macht, and wealth, which is Vermögen, are etymologically very close. It has kind of the same, they're cognate of each other. So magic, power, and wealth, you know, it's just different aspects of the same sort of idea. And what, so here we get kind of crazy here, like, what finger you wear it on matters. Think about your wedding ring.
Yeah, always goes on your left hand right next to your index finger.
So even Romans had this idea that there's an artery that goes from your ring finger. I mean, I'm looking at my left hand right now and I see it. That goes all the way to your heart. Oh. So it's a lifeline. And so they would... you would see old Germanic coins where they would copy the Roman profile of a face, but they're Germans, and they would see them with like a thumb ring. So we know that they had different rings on different fingers. They also had like arm rings, and the exhibit didn't just talk about finger rings. It was the idea of, we've talked about I'm going to mispronounce it again, an Ouroboros or whatever, the snake eating its own tail.
Right.
And often it's a figure eight, but hundreds of examples also exist of it just being a ring. Even with runes, even with, you know, Greek from the Byzantine era. And we talked about that in alchemy, you know.
You talk about the ring finger, which is the third finger in from the thumb. And you look at, you see in these movies, you see, you know, Godfathers and mafia wearing the pinky rings, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, mm-hmm. Some people can pull it off, some people can't. I'm not gonna throw
you
stones.
You got to be Italian American.
Maybe, I don't know.
Or Sicilian.
I don't see rings on the index finger that much.
Yeah.
Is there a reason for
it? I do. You're talking to the wrong person because I wear a ring on my index finger. But
to punch people? Is that what you...
That's what it is, yeah. That's a good question. Specifically, is this what's not on my wedding ring and it's the same size? Like, I'm just that shallow.
That's what it is. Okay.
But so in Wagner, there's the ring of the Nibelungen, which the kind of nymphs, the river elves. Boy, I'm going to get crap for people that actually know like these tales, these legends. But you know, they take it away from... I'm going to get in trouble again. Is it Thor or Odin? But you know, there's this ring of power that Wagner wrote about in his operas, J.R.R. Tolkien, obviously. And even that was... So the elves create their rings, but then Sauron secretly creates a ring to control them. And think about the Olympic rings, right?
Yeah. All the different colors.
Representing the five different peoples of the world, or, you know...
I participated in the Paralympic Games to a certain extent as an alternate.
Humble brag.
Yeah, they're humble brag. I didn't even get to go to the show. I stayed at home. Cut that part out. I was told that those colors of the ring represent all the colors in all the flags in the world.
Yeah, okay.
Not the
people. But it's supposed to... Yeah.
Right.
I also like the five continents. All the
symbolism is
the
huge.
The whole world.
Right,
yeah, it's all the peoples of the world. Wedding rings, like the Ouroboros... I'm sorry, folks. But it, you know, just like royal rings would definitely symbolize the exact same thing, which is eternity. So, you know, it's a cyclical thing. So Germanic and Celtic peoples, you can easily imagine, you know, the cycle of the year.
Yeah.
You know, that what ends is also the beginning. Every point on a ring is also the beginning. But think about like slave chains. It's a lot. But there's a Greek myth. The guy that had to... Was it the guy? Prometheus, who stole fire. So eventually he was kind of forgiven, but he had to keep one of his chains, chain links, and wear it as a ring as a reminder that he did mess up that one time. So, you know, even like shackles. And we see this in Germanic times too, like shackles with chains that were in the exhibit. And so even, you know, a way to constrain somebody or hold somebody back.
I look at it in today's modern era that, you know, I've got friends that are married but specifically do not want rings because it represents bondage.
I was going to say, this is a bad context.
And so I said, you know, so what happens when you go to a bar and someone's trying to pick it? Because what it does is it also wards off other people.
I wore my ring long after my divorce when I went to the bar. It's just like, hey.
Exactly.
Leave me alone.
It's ownership, but it's also say, let me help you make the decision that I'm not for grabs. And the deal is that some people feel that they're free of that. So so you do have the other side of the coin of saying what rings represent and what they don't represent.
There's a romantic idea, but for some people it might, you know, that might take a whole different context out of that. Yeah, so we might say, oh, it's the artery to your heart, or it symbolizes eternity, just like a king's reign should last forever. You know, same exact idea, but...
Let me ask you this. Here in Prague, we've got these great stories of alchemical folks trying to make gold, especially here at Prague Castle, right? And it was known that in that time, your prowess as this alchemical engineer was your beard. Your beard gave you power.
Right.
And there's a great story of Rudolf II, Emperor Rudolf II, he said, I had enough. I'm going to get all you guys in there. I need to make gold yesterday. All right? You guys are screwing around. Yep. I'm going to put you in the tower, the Black Tower at Prague Castle, by the way, right? And he locked him up there. And as a result, they were like, you know what?
We're revolting.
It's too hot
in here.
So they shaved their own beards.
Yeah.
And his result to that was like, well, then you can take the long leap off the bridge into the moat. Because you don't do that to the emperor.
Lock them in cage and feed them to the bears.
And feed them to the bears.
Or starve to death. Yeah.
So the beard was a symbol. But did you know of any guys that, especially here in Prague, that were doing alchemy, that invested themselves in these talismans, like rings and necklaces?
Definitely. Yeah. Here in Prague, per se, I don't know, but it's such a common thing.
Yeah.
Like, I could see an alchemist... So, the rings were also used to identify people. Like, if you think of the Ziegel ring. The what's that in English? That's not an English word. The word where you stamp a piece of wax.
Yeah.
There's a word for it.
Well, it's a signet.
A signet. Yeah, yeah, a signet ring. Mm-hmm. So like nobility would wear that. Like I could easily imagine alchemists wearing a even something around their neck or a ring that would identify them to each other. Kind of like a Masonic, like a well, there we go. There's Masonic rings, for instance. Right. So they can kind of, you know, tell each other if you know what you're looking for, you say, okay, that's, you know, he has that alchemical knowledge.
To me, I would think that they would actually not have rings only for the reason that the chemical reaction for whatever the ring was made into would be so close to what they were doing, you know, could have mixed or caused problems that they did not intend. What if the ring came off? Let's say that it caused problems.
There are alchemical rings. Hold on. This is jumping ahead a little bit, but yeah, I'll get back to it. So there was one story of Electro Magico, electrum, but not electrum like silver and gold. It's just this other material. And it did sound like an alchemical ring because it was made out of lead, mercury. It sounds like an alchemical recipe.
Oh, that doesn't sound good for your health.
And it doesn't sound good for your health. But clearly, so the same, this wasn't from an alchemist though, but it was from one of the books in Leipzig? I think this was part of the exhibit in Halle. Even the creation of the ring sounded like an alchemical recipe. Like it's mixed with gold and you're pouring it at the right hour of the sun, etc. Oh yeah, because I read the spell of it, so it was in Leipzig. It had the tetragrammatron, the name of God, written on the inside or outside. And this was at the very beginning, we mentioned like it could tell if someone's going to poison you or hurt you. So the ring would turn black if you touch it to food and there's poison in it.
Like a mood ring?
Like a mood ring.
What?
It would get blood spots on it if an enemy is nearby. Like the hobbit's sword would glow if there was orcs. This would get blood spots on it if an enemy was nearby. And if on the left thumb, it was an invisibility ring, just like the hobbit. So again, forgive us for that. But seriously, like this was a trope.
When I'm in an awkward situation, I like to pretend that I'm invisible.
Yeah,
so that's
so you just
kind
put
of
that on your ring,
exactly,
your Bilbo,
and you're like, you know, why are you not paying attention to me? I'm not here right
Pete
now.
Pete Baggins.
I'm not here right
now. Now the ring, the same ring, by the way, would also break to pieces when put on a finger of someone unloyal. So if you use it as an engagement ring, and that's not the one for you, it would just break to pieces.
Now let me think about this as a biometric situation. Let's say that you have blood spots on your ring because you think someone else is here to hurt you. What if you're somewhat subconsciously aware that you're in danger and your pheromones, but let's say your chemistry and your skin changes a little bit because you're sweaty, you're nervous, your heart rate goes up.
So it
maybe
tells
the metal
you,
changes and you're
it's like a smart ring that's telling you your heart rate's
exactly,
going up.
You think it's magic, but basically it's measuring your
fingers turning
your acid in your skin or something, that you're afraid of something.
Right. It could be. I don't know if it was that accurate is the problem.
Yeah.
In Roman times, they also had not a key chain, but I saw this ring with a key on it. So you'd have to take the ring off to use it, but it would open a lockbox. So literally like a ring representing access to something. A crown. What is a crown but just a ring, right? So it also symbolized like eternity and you're going to reign forever. Okay, one more thing. Have you heard that are they going to make the Silmarillion into a movie?
I haven't heard that.
So I know there was talk about it years ago,
but
haven't.
It's what they call a deep cut in the industry.
I don't know
if anybody would get it.
It's crazy. So again, for the J.R.R. Tolkien fans out there, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I apologize. Because that was in the Silmarillion where they backed up and told the whole story of the creation of the ring. This is important for the episode. So. Who made it and what, then they kind of describe that these elves created these rings. They're 12 rings of power or whatever, 7, I don't know. The dwarves had some, the people had some, but then Sauron made this ring to kind of bind them all. He also, the reason I'm mentioning this is not just for pure nerdism, but he put a chunk of his own power into it. And that's kind of another interesting thing is that you're investing your own energy or you're investing your own kind of power into these objects.
Right.
That is not something that he invented out of thin air. Like that is something that was mentioned in the exhibit over and over or even in these books. So there's one ring that would give you the strength of 12 men. There's rings that were made out of horseshoes of the devil's horses. So I don't know how they got a hold of the devil's horse's horseshoe, but and also gallop parts. So,
What parts?
Like of a gallows, like the nails to hold up the gallows.
Well, that's kind of spooky.
Yeah. So right. All these weird things, like you mentioned alchemical, like what if you had a bad reaction or what if it was too close to what you're creating? If you think of silver, like silver was thought to ward off witches anyways.
Yeah.
So the fact that a lot of these rings are made out of silver is just a talisman in and of itself. Just the material of it would ward off witches, demons. It was also thought to ward off sicknesses like rabies, like very specific. They would say like, wear this ring and you're not going to get rabies. Or even like, because they didn't know what epilepsy was. You know, so if people were epileptic and they were having seizures, they would give them a silver ring sometimes to do that. We talked about this Kabbalistic, so rings with Kabbalistic symbol to heal, in German like Wenden, which is almost like to turn towards the better. So to heal, but you know, to kind of change your fate to not become sick, but to become well. Silver chains on babies, so it would ease the teething pains like that. So they would put these.
I've never seen that in paintings. I've never heard that before.
Okay. Now, you do know the idea of a silver coin
or the silver spoon in your mouth.
Silver spoon. That's a great one.
Okay.
Silver spoon in your mouth when you're it's a kind of a what. Analogy or something.
It's a gift for a newborn baby.
Yeah, that's
to say. So they're. I always thought it was because it's supposed to be rich. Like the baby would always be rich.
That's what we say now. Yeah. But yeah, it was like you give a silver spoon to a baby in hopes that they will create more wealth. Same way that a silver ring as part of a bridal gift would then encourage the wife to have wealth and be prosperous in the marriage. You do know, like, the silver coin in the mouth of the deceased. Mm-hmm. So the silver eyes was to pay...
For the boatman.
The boat. But yeah, even in medieval times, like, even when Christianity took hold, you'd still sometimes put a silver coin in their mouth. And we talked about, like, vampires on Bohemian and, what was that graveyard?
And werewolves.
So the same... Silver and werewolves, great one. Yeah, same idea. Women in Bohemia would put silver rings on when sewing so that this, it's a Bildwisschnitzer in German. It's a sort of field ghost, if you will. They got really specific with their ghouls and goblins. Bildwisschnitzer will not harm the crops. So you're sewing, you're doing something totally different, but it was a protective way to kind of protect your household in this thing. Also, Bohemia, because we're sitting in the nation's capital, a heckpfennig, so a sort of penny, which was a Bohemian coin, just the one of the lowest denominations.
Okay.
But they would cut a snake tail out of a groschen, and then it was called a heckpfennig. And when you spend this, it's sure to return to you. So you're like, okay, I'm spending money, but I'm gonna get this back because I somehow put a spell on it in a way. That's a Czech thing. Iron. Okay, a coffin nail. This was already mentioned by Pliny the Elder, our good friend Pliny. Sorry, it's Pliny for those out there that are pedantic and pedestrian and kind of petty.
You've been wanting to say pedantic and pedestrian all day.
All day.
And you're looking straight at me.
So Pliny the Elder is how it's pronounced. He already mentioned a coffin nail would ward off demons, for instance. Sometimes you would carry a piece of steel or iron as you go to sleep at night to protect you from, they had night terrors and they didn't know how to explain it. So, if you were susceptible to night terrors, well then, hold this iron bar. No, but a little piece of steel or iron to protect against those demons. And unbaptized babies. So before babies are baptized, if you're Catholic, they would be protected with iron hatchets or knives in the crib.
Which makes sense.
You're putting these sharp objects.
I don't know about the sharp objects part of making sense, but they probably had their reasons. But of course, with high mortality rates for infant mortality, if you didn't quite get them to baptize, their soul might be gone.
Yep. So you give them some protection.
Just to get them through until
you're able to get them through that date when you can. Yeah.
Yeah.
We mentioned the horseshoe, Vodan, Odin, and you'd hang it above a door. You'd also give sick animals water in which red hot iron was cooled. Like think of a blacksmith, he's cooling off a sword or something.
Okay.
And you give that water for animals to drink. And okay, so I just put like ... ellipses because there are so many more examples of, obviously on the alchemy show, we'd like metals equal something else. But a quick definition. So there's a talisman, and this is blurry, but a talisman should bring you luck, whereas an amulet should cause protection. It's way more fluid than that, because we're talking folk magic, right?
Right, so
people weren't even always literate. And finally, so I want to talk about these folded lead sheets again. So Mirko was, the Buddler was a part of the team to kind of first decipher some of these. And by the way, Buddler is a great person to go to a museum with because he'll just stare at this like super, he can read the old handwritings, which I'm just like staring at gibberish basically, but he's, you know, going through it. It doesn't matter if it switches to Latin, he keeps going. But he could like look at a ring or look at these metal, these lead sheets and read what's there, where it's like, it was written by people that couldn't always write, just text copies, and there's spelling mistakes copied over and over, just turns into kind of gibberish, but he can decipher it because he's been staring at it until he went blind, more or less.
Yeah.
And there's also mixed with Christian symbols. Like there's one lead plate where the whole thing is a crucifix, and then the writing is written around it in the you know, spare areas. And when you fold it, it's like folded towards you. And then also it's kind of like Jesus is hugging you because, you know, he's on the crucifix, on the cross, arms stretched out.
Okay.
And then it's folded like this. So it's this whole idea of protection, like you're in Jesus's embrace, let's say. So rings, this is from Mirko's article. So rings would have engravings on the inside and out, sometimes on the inside, because it wasn't so obvious to passerbys that you're wearing a magic ring, which could be a red flag in this, you know, very religious society. Again, like often with Bible verses, kind of abbreviated, or the Ave Maria, kind of abbreviated. And not just encrypted rings and letters, but there's whole articles on ciphers in that book. So just this is the stuff for that make my, like the alchemy thing tingle, because there's whole alphabets that are just, it looks up like just scratchings and claw markings and whatever. But some of these books actually deciphered that, or, you know, would have them written like, here's the alphabet in this weird script. And, you know, this, and, you know, that's just encrypted several times. And then folded into lead sheets and, you know, written for people that can't write, for people that can't read. So these would be folded up and never unfolded. So there was even forgeries. They were just like, you're never going to see what this is anyways. And just kind of like, haha, joke's on you. Sort like literally, like just, you know, someone's just like, here, I'm going to sell you this really expensive lead talisman.
Yeah.
Don't open it. It'll lose its power. And on the inside, it's just like pictures of the leprechaun. It's just nothing, you know,
yeah.
Just, so really interesting, kind of this whole new field of study with these lead folded up pieces of paper, like tin foil. And this is a really interesting space. Everything we've talked about is in between this Christian sanctioned prayers and words and totally forbidden folk magic.
Mm-hmm.
Even priests and pastors doing it, you know, mm-hmm. even Protestant pastors doing this.
Because it's, you know, to me, it's because it's tangible. You know, faith is not tangible.
It gives you something to hold on to. It's
right.
On your neck or it's in a ring, and it just makes you, it's a placebo effect in a way. Some listeners might have a problem with me saying that, but in a way, it just gives you confidence that like, oh, I'm protected. I'm not going to die of the plague every freaking day.
The world was a tough place to live in 500, 600, 700 plus years ago.
Yeah.
And you don't know what's going to happen from one minute to the next, but, you know, even within churches, the idea of having a crucifix in your house, the idea of having something around your neck, the idea of having a wedding band, those are all forms of protection and putting faith into something tangible.
Yeah.
So this, in this sense, was to take it to a whole other level, wasn't it?
Yeah. And it's interesting that we're talking protection. Like in the Middle Ages, we're talking about protective, like white magic, if you will, which was the restoration of order. So you wanted the sick to be healthy, you wanted to protect against evil. But if this is your field, if you know about lead magic spells, you might know this from the Roman period where they would carve curses in lead and bury it with the dead. Like if you disturb this grave, you're gonna get the pox kind of thing.
Okay.
So it was, you know, is that black magic? I don't know. But if instead of curses, we're talking protective, amulets, I guess, and talismans. The writing and creating of the lead leaves itself was a sort of magical process. So here's the interesting thing: if you say a prayer, it has this fleeting effect, right? You're just kind of you say an Ave Maria or the Lord's Prayer or even just, you know, a Protestant like help me, Amen kind of thing. But then how long does that last? Does that last a lifetime? Does that just last for the day? Whereas if you write something down on a as part of a talisman or an amulet, you're really it's forever. So you wear the written words around your neck. It's the idea of carrying a crucifix with you.
Yeah.
You always have that symbol. It's not just a fleeting, like a one time, like, oh, I'm, you know, I accept Jesus as my Lord and Savior, and then you move on with your life. It's like a, no, I always have this. Same thing as a wedding ring. It's a permanent sort of thing. So even by writing down these ideas, like these protective spells or whatever, or a Bible verse, it's like you're carrying that with you forever. So I think that's about where we could wrap it up. I would say check out the show notes again for past access, for the secret cabinet. My own personal projects are, there's a Podcastnik YouTube channel and a Podcastnik audio feed. They're not the same thing. On the audio feed, I interviewed Pete, so you could figure out more about who Pete is.
Sure.
And his whole life and fencing and, you know, all that stuff.
You also have a good friend that wrote a book on alchemy, didn't you?
Yep, and that either was just published or will be the next episode, depending on how this works out. I assume it was the previous episode. So go listen to that episode for a blurb on the book. You can find the book on alchemy on Amazon. Joe Herlihy is the author, and I think I'll put that in the show notes as well. And also there's another blurb on, I'm going to put the book front and center on podcastnik.com, on historyofalchemy.com. If you've only seen historyofalchemy.com, do check out podcastnik.com. Again, it's in the show notes.
I kind of feel like you need to write these things down, folks, because we got a lot.
It's in the show notes.
Yeah.
It's written down right for you. Just scroll down, would you?
Okay.
Yeah, take a look at your smart device or your computer or whatever you're looking at. Just scroll down a little bit. There's the Podcastnik shop. We have alchemy merch out, soon to be more.
T-shirts, stickers.
That also includes a magical...
Dog bandanas.
Yeah, our logo has a magical symbol in it, you know, Ramon Lowell's computer.
I do remember that.
There were similar versions of that in these books in Leipzig. So
yeah,
these like magic circles of protection and all
so
that.
So put one on your dog, he's good to go.
That also is a thing, yes.
Right? So if you can tell, we talked at the top of the show that we're very busy fellas. And it was kind of like, we always like to start these shows, we haven't done them in a while, with an apology. But it's like, we're sorry, but we're not sorry. Because here's the thing.
We
love doing these shows on alchemy and Czech life and Bohemian. And we still want to keep them alive. And we love the fact that you subscribe. Please keep, you know, that going with us, because we have so many more stories to tell you. Just keep in mind that we're both on different parts of the planet, just not here today. We're actually in one room today, which is nice. And we have different things going on that relate to our shows.
Right now, if you listen to this, like when it's published, there's a GoFundMe to help me make candy. We both got day jobs. We're both trying to survive here. If you want to kick us to make another episode soon, you know, you can review us on iTunes. We appreciate that. And we take that into effect. We're like, hey, people are, you know, looking at us on iTunes and reviewing us on iTunes. I feel guilty for not making another show. And we do. This is a pure guilt trip right here. This is what we're doing. No, but
this is nice, though. It's nice being in the same room again.
Yeah.
In the same city for a change.
Yeah.
And last time you were here in Prague visiting me, it was 2 years ago.
Yep, it's been 2 years.
So that's
probably the last time. I don't even then is probably more history of Germany stuff, because the audience is just so much bigger.
Yeah.
That's not your fault. You're listening. You guys are great, but other shows are way bigger. If you want to support us, we got Patreon pages, we got PayPal, and you know, if you give a donation on PayPal, it's like make more alchemy episodes. That tends to be a good indicator that we'll do so.
And I got to tell you too, I can speak at least for my Bohemian audience. And Travis can speak for all the other audiences he's on. When we get a comment that you guys send us, you know, either on iTunes or on our website.
You can just reach out by email or on the website.
Either one is great. But boy, I tell you what, they make us kind of galvanized a little bit more to do more work and even work late in the hours until 2 in the morning.
Sometimes we get so tired when we get home from work, we forget that you guys are all out there and waiting for the next one. So.
Exactly. And on top of that, we also do get criticism, and those critiques actually help us make the shows better.
Oh, so, I don't mind those at all.
Yeah, please keep them coming.
You can just poop all over us if you want.
is that the technical term? Okay. Yeah. All right.
Kind of keep it clean here.
Yeah. So with that, we're going to wrap up this episode of History of Alchemy with Travis and Pete, and we want to thank you all for listening. Remember, you can take a look at podcastnik.com for all information coming your way. So until next time. Oh, yes, Travis?
In fact, on podcastnik.com, I just updated the Who We Are section. There's a little blurb about the whole team. Budler, Judith, you, me, Imad, our Syrian refugee that translates History of Germany into Arabic, by the way. Mm-hmm. Please help us spread the word that there's History of Germany in Arabic. For refugees living in Germany was the idea, but you know, anybody that speaks Arabic could have a listen. And I wrote down the podcast next story. So like kind of how this even came to be almost 7 years ago now.
That's good.
That's crazy.
Now, I think that was worth stopping me my mid-roll goodbye. So let's do it again.
Frankly, I'm
so
sick of you.
So until next time.
I don't want to hear it.
Until next time for the History of Alchemy, this has been Pete and Trav. Take care and have a good night.
Bye.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.